Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, President Obama claims he's scaling down the U.S. military, but it will still be more expensive than all the other militaries in the world. And college students organize against mass incarceration.
But first, the presidential primary process is in motion, with Republican Mitt Romney having eked out the slimmest of victories in Iowa. We spoke with Paul Street, the activist and author who was on the scene in Iowa City. He says Romney's narrow win wasn't the outcome the White House wished for.
I think it was bad news for Obama. I don't think they're happy simply because Romney won, even though he came in late, didn't invest a lot of money in it till late, and he still came out on top. It's just bad insofar as the only one in the GOP field that I think can beat him and make it a close race is, in fact, Romney. They had nominated Gingrich for Santorum or Rick Perry or Michelle Bachmann. They might as well just hand presidency on a silver spoon to Obama. Romney's probably the only one of them there who can give him the run for his money. The far right-wing sort of Tea Party-affiliated types of Republicans will mobilize Obama's disappointed liberal and progressive base. A lot of those people who wouldn't make phone calls or knock on doors or maybe even vote themselves really would have come out, or really will come out to stop a Rick Perry or a Gingrich or a Bachmann. Romney's just a little less strident, little, you know, not really evangelical, less affiliated with the social conservative type of thing, and really not all that different from Obama when you really get down to it in policy terms at all. Look at the health care bill that passed Massachusetts and the one Obama Democrats passed in 2010.
You seem to be saying that with enthusiasm for Obama absent among his base, that he would have done better to have the fear factor on his side with a victory by one of the more troglodytic Republicans.
Right. And there was this good show before, in fact, really scary right-wing, racist, sexist named Rick Santorum. But it's not likely to translate outside of Iowa at all. Huckabee did very good in Iowa, too, in LA, because you had these really extreme proto-fascistic, evangelical, right-wing, white nationalist Christians in the western part of the state in particular. And they're just completely nuts. And those right-wing conservatives are very agitated in Iowa in particular about the gay rights issue, because the Supreme Court here legalized gay marriage a couple of years back, and that just drove them completely nuts. And Santorum is just absolutely rabid about gay rights on that issue. So I think Santorum's success, well, it was interesting in Iowa, in part because he was the last guy standing. These people, these right-wingers kept imploding, and he was sort of the last guy there. And it all sort of filtered towards, plus he had that standing on the gay rights issue. So I think it's a very Iowa-specific type of thing.
Well, certainly the Obama people would have liked to have seen one of the more troglodytic candidates as his opponent, if only because they could draw a line in the sand that is so far to the right.
Right, so that they themselves can move further and further to the right and become completely indistinguishable from the Republican Party. That's right, and that's their whole deal. That's what we've been tracking for the last 2 years, and that's what we, in fact, predicted. So, yeah, the further right their enemy they can have in the general election, the more they can scare their liberal base. What's really interesting in Iowa is that insofar as anybody has an anti-war message or has a message against these police state measures in this draconian surveillance state, incarceration state, it's this guy Ron Paul, who does sort of have consistent libertarian positions when it comes to foreign policy. He really does seem to want to sort of dismantle empire and unjust wars. He does not want to attack Iran, and he doesn't buy the notion that Iran is any kind of particular threat. This is a close they have to get in bed with this guy Ron Paul, who unfortunately happens to be a troglodytian, arch-militant sexist and racist and militant property rights advocate. So these are the choices we're being given by the major parties in 2012.
You've described Obama's alleged shrinkdown of the military as a defense deception. What do you mean?
Well, there's all this talk about how they're going to take $500 million out of the defense system. They've got to, you know, which is what I guess is what the super committee trigger is supposed to do in January of 2013 if they don't hammer out an alternative budget deficit. I don't believe they're actually going to do that. But even if they do, the defense reduction proposals they've been doing lately Are we going to take the Pentagon budget down to what it was in 2007? We are still, whatever Obama, if whatever cuts have to take place, not so much because there's any peaceniks in the White House, not at all, but because these people have just so fundamentally bankrupted their own government with tax cuts for the rich that Obama has passed on from Bush and Cheney. They're still going to be at defense levels that harken back to the Cold War era. We're still going to be spending just hand over fist for the Pentagon system. We're still going to be maintaining more than 1,000 military bases spread across more than 100 countries in the world. We're still going to be accounting for half of the world's military expenditure. And meanwhile, he's saber-rattling on, promising a very possible military conflict with Iran based on the false issue that they pose some sort of serious threat to us and that they have no right to develop a nuclear weapon to defend themselves against such armed-to-the-teeth nuclear U.S. client states as Israel. There's that, and there's also an increasing pointing of the imperial spear out of the White House against China. And an increased deployment of military force, Navy and Marines, into the South China Sea and into East Asia. Asia, which they don't like to admit, but which is all about the growing scramble for offshore oil. Actually, all over the world. Up in the Arctic, there's an increasing naval competition with Russia and Canada in connection with that, but also particularly offshore oil in the South China Sea area. So there's all kinds of provocative moves that will be likely to engender future military conflicts, which will, of course, be funded as they were probably under Bush off the books and Bush military spending through the roof. So I really don't buy any of that stuff about the peace dividend somehow getting implemented under Obama now.
And that is the point, that the new wars that he might conjure up will, like the old wars, be paid out of separate accounts, special appropriations.
Absolutely. It's just from change in hope to continuity and note.
Well, one can understand why there's not much fervor on the Democratic side of the electorate.
Yeah, a lot of people just sat it out. I mean, I went and saw it because I wanted to see it, because I sort of cover this stuff and I write about it, and I sort of was vaguely interested in the uncommitted delegates. There actually were some sort of consistent Democratic progressives out there. And at the caucus that I went to, which is the 24th precinct in Iowa City, the uncommitted delegates got, there was a total of 7 delegates. There was many more delegates in 2008 because there are more people, but this time there was much fewer people. There's 7 delegates, and 2 of them went to uncommitted, to people in the Democratic Party who just could not stand to have themselves affiliated with Obama per se, but just wanted to be associated within it with issues, and in this case, single-payer health care and all troops out of Afghanistan. But, yeah, they're most people sat it out. They don't care. I'm not daring to predict the outcome of that election yet because I think it's very up in the air. I think this is going to be an extremely close contest in all likelihood between Romney and, of course, Obama. And in the end, I think will probably be tipped Obama's way largely by virtue of Wall Street money. Their profits have been through the roof. They've got everything they've wanted under him. They love gridlock in Washington. What they love more than anything else is a powerless state that's factionally divided in such a way that prevents any kind of positive government action for social justice and for economic regulation. And I think they're going to bet on and gamble on the return of Obama for a second 4 years and for continuity over change. But it's not certain at all that Obama's going to win because of the unemployment rates and the continuing problems with the economy, the large percentage of the population that says the country's on the wrong track. It's a little hard to call.
In terms of Wall Street's posture in the race, I think it's kind of interesting. Bain Capital, which was co-founded by Romney, its employees gave Romney about $70,000. Those same employees gave $120,000 to Obama.
There's a game that they play in Wall Street, it seems to me, which is pounding their chest and bitching and moaning about anything they hear from Obama that sounds vaguely populist or progressive. So, you know, Obama himself has even said things to the effect that he understands why people, you know, were in city parks and he understands the anxiety and the fear and the economic restlessness that's out there. But you know he goes back to his backers and say, look, this is the shit I have to say in order to stay in office. And they know that. They know that game. That's the game of American politics, is the manipulation of populism by elitism. And the smarter ones of them, the smarter economic elites know that they've got to let Barack say a few of these types of things. And just as long as he doesn't really do anything all that much substantive to seriously regulate them, and he won't. Why has his core economic team consistently been recruited from the very Wall Street interests that need to be not just regulated, but in fact broken up and cut down to size? He had every opportunity to do precisely that, to break up the Wall Street financial giants in 2009 and 2010. I mean, no less an American elite policymaker than Paul Volcker told Obama in 29, you know, the Wall Street barons' breasts are bare. They destroyed the economy. Now's the time to stick a spear in their heart and cut them down to size. And he absolutely refused to do so in accord with the advice given to him by Wall Street insiders like Lawrence Summers and like Timothy Geithner and like Robert Rubin and like now Gene Sperling, who's one of his top assistants. The very architects of the deregulated regime have been consistently present in the Obama administration. So it's all very, very disingenuous. Obama's done nothing in the way of the Employee Free Choice Act, which would have re-legalized unions in this country. And so I found it all just a continuation of the game that Obama plays, of masquerading as a populist when he, in fact, is a really quite militant Wall Street extremist.
Paul Street is author of The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power.
With President Obama unopposed in the primaries, the Republican candidates have gotten huge individual exposure. But Chicago-based labor activist and writer James Thindwa says the right-wingers don't have a clue how to fix poverty. In fact, they find it hard even to say the word.
In the universe of the conservatives, poverty and good jobs, living wage jobs, do not feature. That they are invested in maximizing profits for corporations, and that relationship, that attachment to corporate profits, prevents them from really having anything even minimally to say about poverty.
Well, the conservatives say that the job creators, meaning big business, that we should be looking out for their viability and jobs will just come.
Right. I've actually been surprised by the relative success of this false narrative of job creators. I'm even more surprised by the failure of, I think, liberals and Democrats out there to debunk that mythology. The job creators are consumers. When you have an economy, both Democrats and Republicans walk around talking about, we have a consumer-driven economy. Well, what does that mean? It means that presumably the consumers that drive the economy. But yet they want to have a successful economy in which the consumers are marginalized. So we've had a 30-year, 40-year history of wages being driven down intentionally by public policy that, you know, incentivizes outsourcing of jobs. And, I mean, you can even go to the Chamber of Commerce website. There's a website where employers can seek assistance to relocate overseas. So you have, on the one hand, this push for a low-wage business model, and then on the other, this continued celebration of consumers in the United States, a consumer economy. So the economy is failing right now. It's not bouncing back because consumers have no money. And it doesn't matter how creative you are as a quote-unquote job creator or employer. If nobody is able to buy your product, you're not a job creator.
Well, you said it, though, 30 years of real wages being depressed, and that, of course, is under Republicans and Democrats. It seems that model that you spoke of is a bipartisan model.
There has been a bipartisan flight from working people and from poverty. Those two words, poor people, don't even feature in the political discourse. How many folks are really talking about it in this election cycle or in 2008 when President Obama ran for president? So there has been a flight. Safe to say that both parties are now captive to corporate interests. There may be variants here and there, but fundamentally they're here to serve capital. And if that's the case, we can't expect any sort of robust strategies to engage the issue of poverty.
On the Republican side, this election season, we are hearing words, code words that are racial in nature and certainly anti-working and poor people that we haven't heard in a long time.
Yeah, and it's kind of a throwback. I think you and I and probably some others who, you know, keep their ear to the ground are really not surprised by this. But I think that a lot of people thought that in 2008, the election of Barack Obama was as much a repudiation of the failure of the Bush years as it was a statement about race, that many white people in America had, in fact, crossed the racial Rubicon. And I think there's an element of that. A lot of people who were voting to have a much more elevated racial discourse, who now are hearing stuff that they thought had sort of receded the margins of political discourse over the last several years. You know, welfare died in 1996. I think someone should write an article, should send a memo to the Republicans that, you know, welfare died in 1996, but they continue to talk as if, you know, you have hordes of people who are just existing to take money and feed off of the public trough. But what's amazing is that this can have any kind of resonance in this day and age. But apparently Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich think it does.
How about what might be the biggest code word of all these days, austerity?
Well, I come from the global south, and we have known austerity for decades. It was usually associated with World Bank and IMF structural adjustment programs that come in and say, you know, the most important action we need to take economically is to freeze public spending, to deregulate, and to privatize. And for too long, I think many of us thought that was just austerity and budget cuts and structural adjustment programs with exclusive province of third world countries. And this only happened in the global south because of the World Bank and IMF, you know, who pushed these policies. But, you know, the United States has been effectively under the same policies for quite some time now. So when you talk to people, when you say you want austerity measures undertaken, you want to cut budgets, it's also code. You're sending a message to hardworking white middle-class folks that going forth, their money will be protected. It won't be going to those lazy and unproductive members of our society, namely black people.
And that code word, austerity, comes out of the mouths of both parties, certainly out of the mouth of this president, who has made austerity proposals that in some ways went beyond what Republicans have been proposing.
In that case, it's not racial per se, but I think that the understanding is that it plays well politically to the middle class. They want the middle class voters. So Obama might use it, but perhaps it might not be in the same way or with the same sort of motivation as Newt Gingrich or people on the right wing. But I think you're right that it's a very useful political device to send a message to the middle class out there that one is looking out for their money, looking out for them.
So where, and I'm speaking to you as a veteran political observer, where does one find the place to draw a line between these Democratic austerity seekers and the Republican austerity seekers?
Yeah, I think what's happening with the Occupy Wall Street movement is very instructive, and I think it's a very important development in American politics, which is a force that has arisen out there that is not attached to either party. In fact, many activists within the Occupy movement are very, very intentional and intent on keeping a distance from political parties. And that's not to say the Democrats aren't trying. I think, you know, MoveOn.org and some of the other democratically Big D connected organizations have been trying to penetrate this movement and try to influence it. So I think that this is an important movement because what it has done is they have replaced austerity and the obsession with budget deficit with a discourse of inequality. I think what this shows is that people have been yearning for a different conversation. I think people find the obsession with the deficits and so removed and so detached. It's only the elites who talk about deficits and act like there's some kind of broad public consensus that this is the number one issue we're facing. I think that with the Occupy Wall Street pushing and doing this, you know, enormous public education and having huge public resonance, it's just showing that people understand that there is money in our country. The country is not broke. I think the scarcity discourse builds on this false notion that the United States is broke. So both politicians, the Democrats and Republicans, walk around saying, oh, we're broke. We can't do this. We can't build roads. We can't build bridges. We can't do this. But, you know, but mind you, we can go to war in perpetuity and find the money to do it. Last year, 400 individuals amassed more wealth than half the country combined. 400 people took home more assets, more money, more resources, more, you know, more income than 155 million Americans combined. The money is going in one direction. It's going to the top 1%. In New York City, 1% of New Yorkers control 45% of the wealth in New York City. That's what the problem is. It's not scarcity. It's how the resources have been distributed over time.
Now I'm going to talk to you as a longtime labor activist. One would have thought that organized labor would be leading this conversation about inequalities.
This is part of the problem. I think that it's hard to analyze where we are right now in terms of the assault on public sector unions, not to mention the sweeping, almost successful elimination of our unions in the public sector, that I think that unions have failed to seize the initiative in terms of framing the issues in our political discourse. If you look at education, the promotion of charter schools, it starts with this narrative that schools are failing. And of course, that narrative is intended to bring focus on the teachers, because if you agree with the premise that schools are failing, you're going to end up, as a matter of logic, on the person who spends the most time with the students, and that is the teacher. So it's no surprise that that conversation has led to the demonization, almost this sort of single-minded focus on teachers as the source of the, as the root of the problem. We should have been saying 30, 40 years ago when they started talking about failing schools, we should have been saying, as a sort of the labor movement, we should have been saying, no, we don't want to talk about failing schools without talking about failing communities. Because a failing school is essentially a canary in the mine for a failing community. It goes hand in hand. And so you can't have a conversation about one, you know, about failing schools without identifying the collapse that has been taking place, the degradation of these communities because of job flight, outsourcing, the advent of the low-wage business model that has been enforced by very elaborate anti-union strategies. So these communities are suffering from economic suffocation. And when that happens, you have dysfunction that essentially captures the whole community. And in that environment, it's very difficult to promote education excellence. So that's the problem. So we haven't really been successful in sort of reframing what the issues are. Anytime you bring up poverty and you bring up social dysfunction, they dismiss you as hopelessly liberal. You're making excuses for failure. You don't want to accept responsibility. But the fact is, family income is still the number one predictor of a child's success in school. It's not the teacher, it's not the most important person in a child's education. It's family income. So that really has to do with the degree to which we haven't been as aggressive and as astute in making the case that education can be discussed in a vacuum outside of the broader context of community failure.
And the same logic or illogic that blames teachers for the failures of public schools can blame workers for the failure of an economy.
Oh, sure. I do think that you're getting to what I think is really fundamentally the problem. I think that institutions like unions, I think you see this more in Europe than here, where unions have a degree of independence from political parties. So I think there's been an effort by a lot of unions to distance themselves from the political parties. Because once you are tied to the hip with a political party, you really can't do what you need to do to critique and to push and to attack when you need to. So I think that there has to be a rethinking of the relationship between labor and Democrats, because it can't be that every 4 years we mobilize and have people go door to door and canvass neighborhoods and donate money to Democrats, and then you can't even get the Employee Free Choice Act passed in the Congress. I do think that unions need to demand better accountability. You can't just be giving money to political parties without some accountability in terms of what you get back in return.
Labor activist James Thindwa in Chicago.
President Obama claims he is committed to seriously downsizing the U.S. military, which costs more than all the other armed forces of the world combined. We spoke with Catherine Lux, editor of the book, The Basis of Power, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Post. It turns out that Obama's military cuts are smaller than the White House would have you think.
If you go back through the whole decade of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you'll see that what actually President Obama inherited was a Pentagon budget that was gigantically larger than the one of 2000 and 2001, which was already pretty large, larger than all other military budgets in the world combined. What we have to look at is what kind of cuts these represent. They simply take us back to the already very inflated budget of 2008, and that's really not much of an achievement.
So we're going back to the level of the last Bush budget?
Yes, very roughly. But what we have to ask is, how did that happen? How did our budget increase so radically? And people say, oh, that's the result of the wars. We were fighting two wars. But the base budget is what we're talking about. The war budgets, the additional $1 trillion allocated to the Pentagon for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are not even included in these numbers. Those are off the table for these discussions, which they shouldn't be. They should be in there.
In other words, Barack Obama could open up new theaters of war and not be violating his commitment of this week to lean down the military, because those new wars would be off the books just as the Iraq war was off the books and Afghanistan was off the books and Libya is off the books.
Absolutely, and I think you're absolutely right to sound a bit of an alarm there because, again, with all of the threatening words that are being exchanged about Iran and the articulated fears about China, we have to worry that there will be a new theater before we know it, and then that will be, as you say, simply money added on top of what is basically going to add up to $2.6 trillion over the next 5 years.
Well, frankly, this really does sound like a rhetorical device. If we're only talking about the base costs of the military, like the costs of soldiers' salaries and other infrastructure, but they can add on in another budget line any new wars, then we're not talking about a military budget that is geared towards a more peaceful world.
No, and that really is the question. Is all of this spending making us and the world more secure or less secure? And I think we have to answer that question as basically, let's look at what's happening in Asia. The Pentagon strategy is now going to refocus on the Asia Pacific. What that means is basically continuing to grow the kinds of arms race that we've seen starting to develop in Asia, where China has been feeling more surrounded and challenged by the United States buildup in Guam, in Okinawa, and now in Australia. Again, there are substantial U.S. forces which have a expeditionary posture, not a local defensive posture. And China might feel justified in feeling that they are under some shadow here.
So we have a press conference, one in which the president is actually saying that we're going to have a focus in the Pacific, which means a more bellicose posture towards China.
Yes, absolutely. And not to mention the problem of U.S. military basing overseas. The United States has been taking land and doing new military base building on the island of Guam. It's a U.S. territory where the local people have a kind of second-class citizenship. They can't vote in U.S. elections, but one-third of their island is taken over for U.S. military basing. And the U.S. is intending to expand, despite the wishes of the people of Guam, to not have their island environmentally damaged as it has been and will be at an accelerated pace. So there's the local effects and there's these international effects, I think both of which we have to be concerned about.
And you're editor of the book, The Bases of Empire, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts.
It's pretty clear that some of the bases in Europe will be shut down. Again, we don't know to what scale, and these are bases which, again, came into existence at the end of World War II and have had no rationale in most cases, even from the Pentagon perspective, I think, from the end of the Cold War forward. So those are long, long overdue closings, but we don't yet know the exact number of those and whether those troops will all be shifted back to the U.S. or whether some will simply go to other bases around the world.
Catherine Lux, author of The Basis of Power, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts.
It appears that Obama's slightly less expensive military will put an emphasis on cheap, dirty little wars in the Third World. Alice Slater is New York director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation.
What they're going to do with the money, with the plenty of money they have left over, is do this high-tech arms race with drones. We're now bombing seven countries right now with drones, totally unauthorized by Congress. And it's so stupid and dangerous. I mean, first of all, they're assassinating people on the ground without evidence, without a trial. We don't know even who we're killing. I mean, even the Nazis had a trial at Nuremberg, which is like so against everything America stands for or believes in. It hurts my heart when I think about it. And the other thing is, drones are very easy to copy. This is not like a nuclear weapon where it's really hard for other countries to catch up to our nuclear technology. And anybody can do a drone. Any computer nerd can figure it out. And so we're now opening up this Pandora's box of ills and bombing people all over the world, and it's definitely going to come back on us.
The United States and its NATO allies just finished a seven-month aerial bombardment war against Libya, a war that President Obama claimed was not a war at all.
Oh, you know, we have figures of how many civilians were killed in the thousands. And that was, you know, no war at all. We were supposed to be protecting civilians. That was the fig leaf that we got from the UN to go in there. The other thing about that war in Libya, it's so sad because Gaddafi gave up his nuclear weapons and then we bombed the hell out of him. How are we going to get North Korea and Iran not to have nuclear weapons when they see what we do to Gaddafi? I mean, if Gaddafi had nuclear weapons, we wouldn't have been bombing, you know, all over Libya the way we were. So it's a signal to people on the other end of our aggressive power that they have to protect themselves as best as they can. I mean, we have almost 1,000 military bases all over the world. What is this about? The Cold War's over. Who's the enemy? I mean, they're creating an enemy of terrorism. We're creating the terrorists just by our very actions. It's like blowback.
Let's look at the Libya war for some indications as to what a leaner, meaner U.S. military machine really means. The Libya war was not budgeted. It will have to be paid for out of some other kinds of monies. And President Obama said that it wasn't even a war. Is this the kind of war or non-war that we can look forward to in the future?
Well, this is, you know, an old story in America. The Korean War, Truman called it a police action. You know, I mean, in order not to get a full democratic, vigorous debate on whether we should go to war or not, which is what the Constitution requires if we go to war, that you need two-thirds approval of the Congress to go to war. Instead of doing that, we make up stories that these aren't really wars. And then you're giving the executive tremendous authority. I mean, Obama, he just suspended habeas corpus and the Magna Carta in the United States. They can throw anybody in a dungeon and lock away the key. You know, if we wanted to save money on the military, we are spending $180 billion on three nuclear bomb factories, new nuclear weapons and delivery systems, missiles and submarines and bombers to bring nuclear weapons around the world, which we absolutely can't use. We could be cutting those weapons. I mean, Russia and China have asked us to negotiate a treaty to keep weapons out of space. They've asked us at different times to cut the weapons and go for nuclear disarmament and call all the countries to the table and get rid of these miserable things, and we'd be saving $180 billion over the next 10 years. Just think what you could do with that money, with schools, with roads. All our best brains are going into designing military machines of death. We're on the wrong path.
President Obama came into office with much fanfare about wanting to move towards a nuclear-free world. But in fact, the United States continues to upgrade its nuclear weaponry.
That's right. I mean, he won the Nobel Peace Prize for this Prague speech where he said, I'm looking to work for a nuclear weapons-free world. But he did qualify it. He said it might not happen in my lifetime. And then I thought Hillary was really something because she was quoting him and saying it won't happen for several lifetimes. So it's not on the table for them. They just want to control it. You know, they want to make sure other countries don't get it, which is like almost, they remind me now, our government and these policies, it's like a little baby playing peekaboo in their crib and they cover their head and they think because their head is covered, nobody can see them. And that's how we're talking. I mean, we're talking as if we're being democratic or we want arms control or we want a nuclear weapons-free world. Meanwhile, if you just look at what we're doing, it's the exact opposite. I mean, Obama really has done that to the nth degree. He talked about getting rid of nuclear weapons. He's putting even more money into it than we ever spent before.
Alice Slater of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation in New York.
In Washington, Howard University PhD candidate Benjamin Woods help organize Students Against Mass Incarceration, or SAMI. Woods says the group began in February of last year and has been steadily expanding.
But our mission of our organization is to organize around issues of political prisoners, the prison industrial complex, and recidivism. Kind of grew out of students at Howard taking courses, actually, on the Black Power movement. Some of the students read books by people like Sophia Bakari, who was a former Black Panther Party member and part of the Black Liberation Army political prisoner. We actually read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, actually in another class, some of them wrote political prisoners and received word back. And once they did this, some of the students who, some who were familiar with this, others who weren't, said, you know, we got to do something. We don't just want to sit on this information on top of the hill. So we wanted to really get in the community and organize. So began the process of starting an organization and connected with different groups. You know, we just started within the last year. We have chapters now at Morgan State, Western Massachusetts, and one at Columbia. And the Columbia group is one of the groups that helped to lead the Stop, Stop, and Frisk Day, I think the student day they had in New York City.
Black Agenda Report columnist Dr. Jared Ball recently wrote that the movement should utilize the expertise and the analysis of actual live political prisoners. You've been putting that in practice, haven't you?
Yes. One of the things we do is we go into Jessup Correctional Institute, where Marshal Eddie Conway has been imprisoned. He's a political prisoner who was accused of murdering a police officer in 1970. There's no physical evidence that connects him to a crime. He's there on the word of a jailhouse informant. But once he went inside, he still continued to organize. And what he has done is he started several things he's done. He's even started to the point of starting unions inside the prison at one point. One of the things, he started a program called A Friend of a Friend, which is a mentoring program for prisoners, for younger, older prisoners to mentor youngers who are coming in, doing everything from conflict resolution issues to debate to history, just various things. And we work with that program once a week and just came from there. We actually did a presentation on history, African history, and we talk about different things. We managed to set up a college course with Dr. Ball, you mentioned earlier, and we started a newsletter as well called Unity and Struggle, and we actually have brothers who are incarcerated in Jessup write in that as well. It's quarterly. We just put one out in November, the first issue, and we'll have another one out in February. So Mr. Conway will write in as well. We take excerpts from different other political prisoners, like last one had Jaleel Muntakim, part of an excerpt from his book, We Are Our Own Liberators. We're really trying to bring back that analysis, particularly of that time period, particularly the Black Power movement, because though it's not in fashion now, Obamaism is what's in fashion. But we have to challenge that in a different analysis of an anti-capitalist, anti-prison, anti-imperialist, and prison abolitionist analysis, which is controversial to some. But when you look at the prison industrial complex, this connection between big business and the government and who's benefiting, you see that it's a system based on profit, the whole prison industrial complex, maximizing profit, and that's capitalism. That is, the prison industrial complex is a direct outgrowth of the capitalist system. So we see that as principally the fundamental problem, and we see a society that isn't necessary to have prisons. One of the books we've read is Are Prisons Obsolete by Angela Davis, and many others have said this. And she asked the question, you know, do we really need prison? Can we imagine a society, use our radical imagination to think about a society that doesn't even have prisons? Because most of the people who are in prison, a large number of them, are there for nonviolent offenses. So the point is, do you really have to have these institutions like this, or is this really just about money making at the end of the day?
Many in what we like to call the black misleadership class appear to be more ashamed than outraged at mass black incarceration.
That's one of the big things we have to challenge, is the class issue, particularly. I was born in the 80s. A lot of us in our group, we're born in the 80s and now the 90s. And our whole lives, we've heard this rhetoric around, oh, you know, our biggest problem is we need to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. We need to just save our money, and, you know, it's because we're lazy. Or, you know, even my personal favorite is that we need to pull our pants up. Young black men would just pull their pants up, you know, somehow our condition would magically change. But, you know, my argument to that is these bankers who did these credit default swaps, these derivatives, securitization markets, and all this fancy terminology, they wear business suits every day. They're the ones who targeted us to say that we're the problem instead of a system that is doing all of this. It's a whole international system, from the CIA's involvement, as Gary Webb has shown in his book Dark Alliance, and others, Alfred McCoy has shown. It's shown that, you know, the CIA has been implicated in this, and you set up harsh drug laws, and then you over-police certain communities. I don't see how you can say that we're our own worst enemy. The enemy is the same enemy we've had for about 500 years now, and that's called capitalism and imperialism. But one of the major issues of that is just this class issue. You know, we have to deal with this within our own community. Just blind racial solidarity, especially as we saw with this last Obama campaign, just is, should show us, especially after he just put an indefinite detention. He's about to sign this law for indefinite detention. So we can't just be blind racial solidarity, because a lot of the people who are in Congressional Black Caucus supported a lot of the legislation. A lot of the, like you talk about the cocaine, crack disparities, 100-to-1. Well, a lot of the CBC voted for that. They supported it. So we have to talk about class in a real type of way within our community.
Sounds like we have to realign the class composition of our leadership.
Exactly. I think that's one of the main things we are really trying to work with brothers and sisters who are getting out of prison. We work with as many as we can, because we see not just students as some sort of vanguard. We've had people tell us that. I mean, you could argue that in the past that's happened, but we really want to see people who are the most affected that are by this as the ones who should be providing leadership. If someone when you go inside of a correctional institute, a prison, or what maybe really a concentration camp, really, you see that you have all these talented young brothers and sisters, extremely well-read, can do art, can do leadership ability. They have the capabilities. It's just they're not being allowed the place to take up that leadership mantle that they need. And I can tell you right now, just coming from Jessup earlier today, you have plenty of people who would be great leaders I would follow. You know, I'm working on a PhD. This brother may not have a GED, but I'll listen and follow him than I will some Negro going to start an indefinite detention. You know, knowing our history of COINTELPRO and the other issues, I can't support that.
That was Benjamin Woods in Washington, D.C.
The People's Organization for Progress, or POP, in Newark, New Jersey, has passed the halfway mark in its daily demonstrations for jobs, housing, education, and peace. The grassroots political organization vows to man picket lines without even a one-day pause for 381 days, the duration of the 1955 Montgomery, Alabama bus boycott. POP's demonstration marathon has attracted national attention and won the endorsement of 150 organizations. POP Chairman Larry Hamm says endorsing the campaign means doing the work.
An endorsement not only means being listed as an endorser, but it also means committing to taking at least one day between now and the 15th of July, July 15th, which is the 381st day, and the last day of the campaign. We're asking each group to pick a day to bring their organization out, bring their flags and their banners and their posters and their speakers, and to use the protests, not only the daily protests, not only talk about jobs, but also to talk about the issues that those particular organizations are concerned about, because we think that there's linkage between these various issues that the different organizations are raising. We're pleased with the progress, and I'm optimistic that between now and July that even more organizations may come on board. I think that by the time we get to the summer months that we may get close to 200 endorsing organizations.
Your organization and this campaign is ambitious not just because of its longevity, but because of the wide range of issues that it's addressing. I suppose that in the beginning, there must have been a lot of discussion about possibly stretching yourself too thin issue-wise as well as in terms of longevity.
We had a lot of discussion. People might not believe it, but the discussion around this effort actually began in a serious way last December, not December of 11, but actually in December of 10, we were beginning to see that we had to take steps to initiate stronger efforts to draw attention to these problems and to try to force various government institutions to do something with these problems. We understood more than a year ago that sporadic protests were not enough, that they were good, because it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness, but that the sporadic protests were not enough, that we needed to do something that was dramatic and that was long-term. And we actually began discussion, and we concluded with regard to the demands that we needed a minimum program. And there, to be honest, debate is continuing in our organization around the seven demands and the possibility of expanding those seven demands. But initially, we felt that we needed a minimum program that could bring together the broadest possible coalition. And that's why we settled on the seven demands, which were national federally funded jobs program to put the 29 million unemployed and underemployed back to work, end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, spend the money for war and domestic needs, protect workers' rights to unionize and collectively bargain, a moratorium on home foreclosures, universal health care for all, save our schools, stop the budget cuts, the layoffs and privatization, and make college education affordable and end student debt. And we thought that that was a minimum program that could draw together a broader coalition. More recently, we've been talking about adding demands such as make the rich pay their fair share of taxes, specifically in New Jersey. That would mean a millionaire's tax, which actually came before the legislature in 2010, but failed to get passage. And also, some people were thinking that maybe we needed to add the issue of police brutality to the demand. We consider those to be demands. The first seven are what we're calling core demands, and then there are other demands that we'll be adding on as we go along. But, you know, there's a tactical question of, you know, if you bring people around together around seven demands and you unilaterally add on, you know, that may not be fair, or organizations may perceive that as not being fair to them. So even as we go along to put additional demands on this program, we will have to do it with consultation of the other organizations.
Now, the People's Organization for Progress is already part of the Black is Back coalition, but I can't believe that you're not looking at this universe of affiliations that you're developing through this campaign to create permanent, larger coalitions.
We do have a long-term perspective on this. POP has always felt that coalition work was necessary. No one organization is going to be able to build this movement, that the movement that we have to build for radical social transformation will have to be a movement made up of the broadest possible coalition with very diverse forces. And there's the rub, as they say. You know, it's easy to unite with people that kind of have your perspective or perspective similar to yours. But it's more difficult to unite with people that may, say, for instance, agree with you on one issue and then disagree with you on some other issues. But I'm convinced that to build the kind of movement we need to build, our unity must extend beyond the people who share the same ideology, same political perspective. We'll have to deepen it and broaden it with other diverse forces and organizations.
Your daily demonstration campaign predates Occupy Wall Street, and the way you're going, it may outlive it.
Well, we'll see. But it is true that we predate it. And, I've thought about this a great deal in the last few months. And one of my conclusions is that other people were also feeling the same thing we were feeling, that we needed to do something stronger. And I'm sure other forces were independently planning things, and one of those things is Occupy Wall Street. But yes, the People's Organization for Progress, Daily Protest for Jobs, Peace, Equality, and Justice, started on the 27th of June. And as you know, Occupy Wall Street started in October of last year. We started in June of last year. They started in October. But that being said, the People's Organization for Progress General Assembly passed a resolution in support of Occupy Wall Street almost the same week that they took over Zuccotti Park. We've endorsed both Occupy efforts, Wall Street and Newark. I think overall the Occupy effort has been good, and in some ways the Occupy movement has helped our movement. Everybody's clear on the fact that the Occupy movement has got, at least in the last, toward the end of this last year, toward the end of 11, tremendous amounts of press. I mean, it was almost unbelievable the amount of press that Occupy Wall Street and the other occupations got around the country. And we think that's a good thing. And we think that that actually helps people to understand why we were engaging in the daily protest. So overall, we think Occupy is good. I mean, yes, we started before them, but we still think their effort is a valuable effort. They made a major contribution in terms of at least putting the issue of economic inequality and injustice in the national discussion. And I hope they continue. Whether they will continue or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, this is what I'm talking about. There's going to be all kinds of forces, seen and unseen, that are going to be out here as this economic crisis deepens and hurts people more and more and more. All kinds of organizations are going to be coming out with all kinds of actions, and our acme as organizers will be our ability to cope with these various efforts as they arise, and while at the same time keeping our own organizational efforts on track.
We're coming up into this election season. Are we going to see the same old syndrome where people say, well, grassroots politics is fine, but right now we've got to elect or re-elect our black president?
I think there will be some negative impact and there will be some positive impact. You're absolutely right. As we get closer and closer to election day, it's going to be harder and harder to get any press on anything that's not related to the election. But on the other hand, it's during presidential campaigns, that's when a lot of people's minds open up to discussing politics or to discussing it in a more vigorous way. And I think that we can actually use that to our advantage and maybe even increase participation, because we're already talking about what are we going to do after the 381st day? And there are some people, I mean, we haven't made a decision, but there are some members who have said, you know, if this thing is really going strong, maybe we'll consider continuing after 381 days. Maybe we should continue it right up until Election Day. Some people have even said that, you know, maybe the day after Obama is elected or the week after, well, whoever is elected, maybe the following week we need to have a million people's march in Washington for jobs. Maybe we need to flip the script right after Election Day with a really bold, massive action that can actually set the course of discussion for the next term. We had a million people march on Washington the week after, the Tuesday after he was elected, or the Saturday after he's elected. I think that that would set the compass of the political discussion in Washington and avert this kind of celebratory discussion that could go on for months and months.
And, of course, if the Republicans win, it'll be a whole different kind of discussion.
Absolutely. If the Republicans if the Republicans win, you think we see people are in pain now. They've made it clear that they're going after any domestic programs, that they're going to balance the budget on the backs of, quote-unquote, the 99%. They will probably want to immediately engage in some type of military adventure in Iran or somewhere else in the world. You know, not that Obama wouldn't do the same thing. There's a lot to be said for the argument that the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans have become more and more narrow. For black progressives and black activists, people are going to have to do some real soul searching this election, because Obama has gotten away with some things that George Bush couldn't get away with. You know, the recent signing of the National Defense Authorization Act, and within that, granting power to the president to have anyone, domestic or international, declared a terrorist and an enemy combatant and have them arrested and detained without any type of judicial process or due process. I don't think George Bush could have got away with that. But Obama is getting away with doing things that Bush couldn't get away with. So either way, the bottom line is this: whether the Democrats get elected or whether Republicans get elected, we should be talking about how we're going to build this struggle and how we're going to fight this war at home, how we're going to fight against the forces of reaction as they attempt to turn back the clock. And the clock is being turned back right now. Civil rights, civil liberties have been under attack. We've lost some of our civil liberties. So regardless of who's in the White House, we're still going to have to fight.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.